Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, welcome. You have found a Masonic Companion on this, the 11th day of May 2017 on the Georgian calendar. Hello, everyone. We're in for an interesting show, trying to upgrade and change the format just a little bit, make it a little more engaging and accessible. And, of course, today is a notable day. This is the day that it's Mother's Day, and it turns 100 today. It's interesting. The first observance was in 1908. A woman by the name of Anna Jarvis started it. She didn't have kids of her own, but in 1905, after the death of her other mother, she decided to organize the first Mother's Day. And on May of that year, families gathered in places around Jarvis's hometown. She lived in Grafton, West Virginia. And people gathered at the local church. It was renamed the International Mother's Day Shrine. And it was largely through her, this woman's efforts, that Mother's Day came to be observed in a growing number of cities until President Woodrow Wilson officially set aside the second Sunday in May in 1914 for the holiday. But it's interesting that this didn't start off with the same kind of zeitgeist that it has today. Do you know? It started off as a very somber, thoughtful kind of a day. It was founded for mourning women. Yeah, to remember fallen soldiers and to work for peace. And when the holiday became commercial, Anna Jarvis did everything she could to fight that. She thought that it took away from the meaning. And she died penniless and broken in a sanitarium. We enjoy the commercial side of things, I guess. That's not the only somber, serious-minded event that has become a source of money in the marketplace, has it? To be exploited? Or as the capitalist system promotes, the Holy Grail is profit. But you and I, we can enjoy this day and celebration. We could quote from William Blake or Robert Browning about mothers. Motherhood, says Browning, all love begins and ends there. Yes, of course. So as a tip of the hat to your mother, happy Mother's Day to all the mothers out there. And if you're celebrating, if you're thinking back over the course of the relationships, remember the best parts. Let the rest slide. There's no room in a good life for that kind of baggage. Just have a good time with it. Have a good time with it. We're going to the episode today is I thought was kind of interesting. Truly, I'm looking forward to our discussion about this. As you can see, it's entitled "Pointing Out Thinness in the Universe," and if you do a little research on your own, you find this idea of there's points, this thought that there's points where the between reality and the spiritual world, that veil becomes very, very thin. Today I want you to join me in the lively conversation on things Masonic. Today we'll talk about an important question. We talk about an important question about Freemasonry. Does it deliver? Does it deliver? When we think about this a little deeper, let's ask ourselves the mystery question. Is the craft hollow today? Or can it deliver? Is it, you know, a shell of what it was or what it can be? We know the provenance. We know the greatness of minds that have been Freemasons. We tend to not look at Freemasonry face-to-face, but angularly. We look at as if it's a... We look at the mirror rather than looking forward to see ourselves in it. From the edge, the mirror can be quite thick and a very fine line. That's the way we look at Freemasonry. As an accumulation of hundreds of years of history. We have not been an order with brilliant scientists, with brilliant architects and artificers and craftsmen squeezing into our lodge rooms. That's never happened. We've accumulated. We've been more like tracer gold. We've been more like the perfect pearl in the oyster. You can open 100 oysters to find one that is just ideal. You don't, every time you pan for gold in the stream, you don't come up with a nugget. Similarly, time has been kind to us. It's allowed us to recognize brilliance. And we are collectors. We are watchers. We collect these notions of great minds and ascribe the connection, the thread being Freemasonry. It's for anybody to suggest that Freemasonry made those men brilliant, I think would be a bit stretching the truth. Now, today we clamor around this notion of making men something different, making a good man better. I have a very, very hard time connecting the dots, connecting our history with that kind of a statement. I don't see how it had any bearing on how the craft started many, many years ago on that Tuesday, the 24th of June, 1717, when the type of protection that allows people like me to practice this form of Freemasonry was first started. And I'm speaking, of course, about Grand Lodge. It protected us from because we were so vulnerable, from charlatans and all manner of criticism and mudslinging. It's still there. Are we influenced? Can we influence a man? And I think making a good man better, I really, for me, it's a bumper sticker. I mean, no offense, but I'm probably offending a lot of people. I don't mean to. I think what What Freemasonry does is gives an opportunity for inspiration, for us to read about a noble history and find a connection between ourselves and that history. As if, in a way, if we're team players, we're not going to let the side down. You have my back, I have your back. Going that extra mile, that notion of dedication, it's important for men to believe in things, to believe in projects, to believe in ideals, to believe that there is purpose. And if Freemasonry does anything, I believe that it inspires. But a mind has to be open to probe and find the nuggets, the pearls inside it that do inspire. Is inspiration a one-dimensional thing? I don't think so. I don't think so. What inspires one man may not inspire another. It may be the suffering of somebody that inspires a young person to go into a particular field. Maybe it's to protect us and to bear arms and put themselves in harm's way. And I think I can sincerely say bless them for doing that. Maybe it's to achieve, to pull themselves out of the muck and the deprivation of their early childhood, thinking about what we were one day. Well, we're not that boy anymore. We're something different. The pious amongst us really don't offer much to this conversation. That narrow-minded judgment really never added anything to the discussion. Are we a hollow organization? I'll be getting into the way we came into the order. We need to talk about that with an expectation that Freemasonry will shatter. We came with expectations. And if you think about the change, the deeper change, Freemasonry will challenge those beliefs that were there with us when we walked through the door. We came with expectations. If learning is to happen, a man alone must ask the question he needs to answer. Good time Charlies really don't need the craft. And I'm quoting from somebody that I won't give a name because I didn't ask permission, but they can find the good time Charlies can find a hot dog and a beer and social connections with a lot of other organizations that actually do that better than Freemasonry. When a fellow begins to mature, I don't say that happens at a particular age. You know, we once upon a time, not so very long ago, men were defined in their early teens, and you would be assuming more what we would think of as an adult role in life at a very early age. Girls were coming into childbearing age from 12 and 13, and they're young, what we think are still children. And the seriousness of life occurred, the responsibilities of life occurred much more at a much younger age than they do today. So when a fellow begins to mature within the side of his own mind and begins to bear the weight of responsibility, he asks, is that all there is? Am I a beast of burden? You're not alone.
I remember when I was a little girl, our house caught on fire. I'll never forget the look on my father's face as he gathered me up in his arms and raced to the burning building out of the pavement. And I stood there, shivering in my pajamas, and watched the whole world go up in flames. And when it was all over, I said to myself, is that all there is to a fire? Is that all there is? Is that all there is? If that's all there is, my friend, then let's keep dancing. Let's break out the booze. And when I was 12 years old, my daddy took me to the circus, the greatest show on earth. And there were clowns and elephants and dancing bears and a beautiful lady in pink tights flew high above our heads. And as I sat there watching, I had the feeling that something was missing. I don't know what, but when it was all over, I said to myself, is that all there is to the circus? Is that all there is? Is that all there is? If that's all there is, my friend, then let's keep dancing. Let's break up the booze and have a ball. If that's all there is. And then I fell in love with the most wonderful boy in the world. We'd take long walks down by the river, or just sit for hours gazing into each other's eyes. We were so very much in love. And then one day, he went away. And I thought I'd die. But I didn't. And when I didn't, I said to myself, is that all there is to love? Is that all there is? Is that all there is? If that's all there is, my friend, then let's keep... I know what you must be saying to yourselves. If that's the way she feels about it, why doesn't she just end it all? Oh no, not me. I'm not ready for that final disappointment. Because I know, just as well as I'm standing here talking to you, and when that final moment comes and I'm breathing my last breath, I'll be saying to myself, is that all there is? Is that all there is? If that's all there is, my friend, then let's keep dancing. Let's break out the booze.
Amazing. Amazing. You aren't alone. Maybe you've noticed you can't go forward and can't go backwards. Maybe you've come into the craft and you're wondering. There's answers there. Do you have to really pretend? Do you have to dumb down the question and put up and tolerate? Well, we're also given an opportunity to learn through this interesting community. We're taught that there are properties within a social context, things that we can learn that draw us out, insights that we can't really develop on our own. If you can't find the answers, where else do you search? It may be that once we get here with this great promise and the anticipation of the philosophical anticipation, it's difficult to give it up without that feeling that we've not applied ourselves, we've not explored all of the nuance, that there might be something that we're missing. And if that's the case, and the organization is hollow, where do you go? Where do you go from there? Money doesn't do it. Or maybe it does for you. Go ahead. Fame and celebrity doesn't do it. They don't answer. They don't give answers. Drinking makes you a liar. There is no place to hide, so suck it up. I guess like Peggy Lee says, is that all there is? We just keep going. Look into the mirror and see the truth. If you've been wandering, wondering, and hopeful, optimistic, We've been searching for you. I want to talk to you about the instrument that has been entrusted to you. Of course you can't play it. You know, it's just been handed to you. You came through the door of the craft. You need instruction. You don't even know if you have any talent. You know? But you'll know within yourself if you're curious about that. And there's a uniqueness when you start with these, you get something for the first time, there's a fascination. We play with it. We see our children doing it. Then oftentimes when they become a bit grumpy or distracted, you'll see people that really don't have the child's best interest in mind, teach them to give up, that it's quite all right, that they're not ever to learn how to persevere. That's the edge of self-discipline. And no, it isn't strapping a child or beating them. Get over it. That's our own adult conceit that does that. It's teaching a child the necessity, and it's when we can show the child how to do that until it becomes something they do willingly. Well, many of us haven't got a clue how to do that without being intimidating, you know. That mindless use of authority. You don't teach using authority. But it still goes on around us, doesn't it? Learn this because I say so. Well, if anything, Freemasonry is the antithesis of all of that. You know, where we challenge the rightness and accuracy of the state and religion. At one point when they were saying this is the way it is because we say it, we said no. Quite objectively, over here we have a little bit of let's call it science, and it gives us some answers that we can rely on, evidence based things. Yeah, it was the great challenge, the release, the Renaissance, wasn't it? The Age of Enlightenment. All of that was given to us because we took it. We knew it. We understood it. You know within yourself if you're curious, but do you have the self-esteem to study? Ah, as Socrates said, a life unexamined is not worth living. Freemasonry brings the past into the future and opens the mind. Curious? Yeah. It's a wonderful time. Great to be alive, isn't it? Just fantastic. We have a little bit of inspiration from William Blake today. We're going to get into, got to give you something serious, the history of the world in six glasses. Yeah. It's sort of uplifting being here with you because I know you're a dedicated, curious bunch. Here's what William Blake said, you know. Get this. This is an interesting, this is a poet. And I'm one of those people that has often said to you, poetry is the expression of the universe expressing emotion. This is how the universe does it, it's through poetry. You throw the sand against the wind, and the wind blows it back again. Now, that's pretty deep there, William. But he also says, this life's dim windows of the soul distorts the heaven from pole to pole and leads you to believe a lie when you see with, not through, the eye. Ha. Huh. As I was walking among the fields of fires of hell, delighted with the enjoyments of genius, which to angels look like torment and insanity, I collected some of their proverbs. And because I am happy and dance and sing, they think they have done me no injury. When thou seest an angel, thou seest a portion of genius. Lift up thy head. Always be ready to speak your mind, and a base man will avoid you. So, intense, huh? Very, very intense. Let's talk a little bit about history. The nice thing about Freemasonry is that it is history. And it is about time, and it is about bringing everything into a contemporary frame of reference. It's the most amazing thing. And I want to just let you know, if you've been wondering how to you know, you have a really brilliant idea, something that's really, you know, it's clever. It's not done to manipulate. You don't come up with something to manipulate, and you're not, you don't have that weaseliness about yourself. You know, you see somebody that comes up with a good idea, they're either patronizing or they're a bit weaselly, like, oh, you know, I just, what's the word? It just annoys everybody that's, you know, watching, understanding. Let's say you got a really good idea. And the attempt to be persuasive can be quite vexing, especially when you see problems going on that are avoidable. You think, man, you know, the solution is so obvious. You all have those kind of moments. You see solutions to the difficulties other people have, and at times, if you have a sense of compassion about you, you'll say, well, if I share this idea, maybe the other person will pick it up and make it their own, just like we all do. Collect brilliant ideas around, and we pass them around. And from time to time, or once in a lifetime, we may add a little bit of our own character to the mix. So the idea of persuasion has something to do, in my mind, with control. You give up control. Absolutely. Give up control. Look for the best in the people around you that you want to influence. Look, and to do that, you have to look for the best in yourself. So you look for somebody's walking around with that sense. You know, the type that are walking around with that sense of self-importance. Don't do that. You know, you don't need me to tell you that. They look like grown men looking like fools, and they really don't have anything to say. If you want to know a little bit more about my thinking on this, go Google this. This is really interesting. Google the relationship between echo and narcissus. That will give you an idea of what I'm talking about. It's the wood nymph, echo, that always had to have the last word, and who annoyed the gods so much that they condemned her to only speak words that were said to her. So when somebody else, she no longer had anything. She had nothing to say in the first place, apparently. She was just chattering away. Go and check that out. It's interesting reading. It's here I am sounding like I'm apologizing in case it would take you a few minutes. It's a quick little idea, but it really, I find, quite a stimulating little bit of energy in the thinking. So check that out. But before we get into that history, let's talk about the delights of wine. Yeah, we're getting into that part of history, and we're celebrating a bit more about life around us. We are part of such an incredibly interesting order. And you know, it's not interesting because we say it is. Too much, I think we rely on rhetoric. It's like if we're patting each other on the back makes ourselves feel well, good. It's like after a while, don't you think we might look a little bit, shallow? That's a bunch of, as the kids would say, a bunch of old guys sitting around puffing themselves up. Oh, ouch. Ouch. I don't like that one. Ouch. I like to think we've got a little more granularity, a little more gravitas, a little more to offer than looking like that. And if we look like that, I don't want to hang around with me anymore. I don't. I just think that's an embarrassment. And if we can't come up with thoughtful discussion about reasonable questions, then oh my God, we're going to sound like fools. Only we get thrown in together. It's like, you know, the old guy driving around in the red sports car with the top down with a young girl beside him. And in everybody's mind, you just look at him and there's a middle-age crisis. Well, thank you. At my age, it's not middle-age, but if I can knock off a few generations with a sports car and putting my daughter in the seat beside me and driving around, maybe I should do it. But he looked like a fool. And do you need to be told, or have you figured that out. We could do that on our own. Oh man, yeah, we have all manner of, you know, just look around. If we can't figure out at our age and degree and level of maturity how to make ourselves look like a fool, just go into any lodge room. we're able to pass those messages on to one another quite readily. But pull back a little bit here. I want to talk to you about this idea of symposia. I remember I want to teach you how to drink like Greeks, not the contemporary. Like, let's dial it back a few thousand years, okay? You remember the symposia was this is where the long-handled ladles and all our friends would get together and would sit around and lounge. And we had, you just think about the genius of this. I think this is clever. Coming from a culture where I'm reading about the culture in Britain and the drinkers, the idea there is that drinking is to intoxication, where you see, the culture is taking this seriously. Why are young people drinking to the point where they're passing out and throwing up and getting into fights, and those types of things? Loss of control from intoxication. Also does some very interesting and radical things to brain texture, but we'll just let that go, you know, until people turn their 60s and 70s and start to find that their mind isn't what they hoped it would be. Everything in moderation, gentlemen. So here, we were brought up in an era where there was a sense that you learned socially about how much was enough. And we learned that from people that drank too much and lost control, and we learned that that probably wasn't too cool. We learned that there was an edge where you were, you know, the tongue would loosen, as they say, and the ideas would flow, and we all would be much more sociable with one another. And we look at that as flirtations and friendliness and camaraderie, where we laugh a little more, we smile a little more, our sports teams are a little more brilliant, and the loss is a lot more tragic. But the next morning, we wake up and dust ourselves off, and we can do it all over again. And when we think about good times, when we were boys, we often think about those moments. Not where we're judging ourselves and saying, oh, that was terrible and that was over the top. Like, what, have we really become that stunted? It was like the fun. That's what we called fun. And we were brought up that way, weren't we? Well, the Greeks weren't much different, only when they had got together, they had people around. I'm not big on slavery, I'm sorry. As a matter of fact, I got to talk to you. We got to do something about what's going on with selling children and women into slavery. Like that. Sorry, I digress, but that is just getting under my skin, brethren. I can't pretend. A lot of guys fought and died too for our way of life, and if that means we've got to impose some of our values around the world, then so be it. Slavery, look out, boys. I hope we hunt you down like the dogs you are. You're treating people and kids like that. I'm sorry. Anyway, babe, don't get me started. So the Greeks would have people around that would make sure that, you know, the guests were not too tipsy and not too sober. Just find that edge where the conversation was lively and keep everybody there. Just think of that, would be great. Like, that's like the perfect bartender or the perfect server. Just keep that buzz going so that if you're not falling down and getting silly and embarrassing yourself, but neither are you sitting there self-consciously thinking about how you sound and what you're going to say. Ah, yuck. Jeez. Oh, it's good. You know, nothing makes you feel creepier than somebody that comes in and gives you that, you know, that sense of self-consciousness. Oh, I have to act a certain way. Got to have a certain impression. Well, I'd rather be around real people and just say, you know, if you don't know who you are and what you are, well, you know, go on over there. Go on. Sit by yourself. I had the occasion last night to sit with real people, great guys from over at Harrison Lodge, Grandmaster's Banquet. It was just a treat to be with the real human beings of the world, you know, talking about the elements and crops and travel and listening to the curiosity of these men and their wives. And And, you know, farming is a family affair. Everybody's involved. Everybody has their own specialization and contribution. So it was wonderful. No self-consciousness. And talk about politics. I can give you an earful. You want to talk about some idiot mayors that are making headlines? I can fill you in on the truth. I'll pass on the truth to you one day if you're interested. Fantastic. Anyway, we're going to talk about this. Imagine you're sitting back, you're relaxed, and you're just at that edge where everything is just, you know, you're brilliant. You're just brilliant. If you had enough to drink, that, you know, your thoughts are starting to flow. They were very, very, there's a drinking game that they had, and this was called Katabos. K-O-T-T-A-B-O-S. Well, you can imagine, and we still do that when we were boys. This involved flicking the last remaining drops of wine from one's cup at a specific target, such as another person, a disc-shaped bronze target, or even a cup floating in a bowl of water with the aim of sinking it. Such was the craze for Katabos that some enthusiasts even built special circular rooms in which to play it. Traditionalists expressed concern that young men were concentrating on improving their Katabos rather than javelin throwing, a sport that at least had some practical use in hunting and war. Well, that was pretty obvious to me. Why are you sitting down playing? As one crater succeeded another, some symposia descended into orgies, others into violence, as drinkers issued challenges to each other to demonstrate loyalty to their drinking group, or hetaria. The symposium was sometimes followed by the komos, a form of ritual exhibitionism in which the members of the hetaria would course through the streets in nocturnal revelry to emphasize the strength and unity of their group. The komos could be good-natured, but could also lead to violence and vandalism, depending on the state of the participants. As a fragment from a play by Eubulus puts it, "For sensible men, I prepare only three craters, one for health, which they drink first, the second for love and pleasure, and the third for sleep." Remember, craters were the container, yeah? That was the big container. Wine was mixed with water. Remember, so this is what he said. Only three. The first you drink for health. Remember, this is still alcohol for health, and it still is, and used that way medicinally today, if we think about it. And then the second was for love and pleasure. We get a little bit of flirtation and enjoyment, and you enjoy the camaraderie of other men. Good times. And the third, just nod off, have a little drink and go to sleep. After the third is drained, wise men go home. The fourth crater is not mine anymore. It belongs to bad behavior. The fifth is for shouting. The sixth is for rudeness and insults. The seventh is for fights. The eighth is for breaking the furniture. The ninth is for depression. The tenth is for madness and unconsciousness. Remember, the third, wise men go home. Huh. At heart, the symposium was dedicated to the pursuit of pleasure, whether of the intellectual, social, or sexual variety. It was also an outlet, a way of dealing with unruly passions of all kinds. It encapsulated the best and worst elements of the culture that spawned it. The mixture of water and wine consumed in the symposium provided fertile metaphorical ground for Greek philosophers who likened it to the mixture of the good and bad in human nature, both within an individual and in society at large. The symposium, with its rules for preventing a dangerous mixture from getting out of hand, thus became a lens through which Plato and other philosophers viewed Greek society. Philosophy of drinking? You bet. You bet. Philosophy is the pursuit of wisdom, and where better to discover the truth than at a symposium where wine does away with inhibitions to expose truths, both pleasant and unpleasant. Wine reveals what is hidden, declares Eratosthenes, a Greek philosopher who lived in the 3rd century. That the symposium was thought to be a subtle venue for getting to the truth is emphasized by its repeated use as a literary form. The most famous example is in Plato's Symposium, in which the participants, including Plato, depiction of his mentor Socrates, discussed the subject of love. After an entire night's drinking, everyone has fallen asleep except Socrates, who remains apparently unaffected by the wine he has drank, and sets off on his day's business. Plato depicts him as the ideal drinker. He uses wine in the pursuit of truth, but remains in total control of himself and suffers no ill effects. You've seen the young boys who all of a sudden realize they have to suck it up because, and they're walking with the shakes and staggers, but, you know, head up, trying to be even quite proper. There you go. Not swearing or not yelling, just making it happen. Socrates also appears in a similar work by other of his students. The main subject, once again, is love, and the conversation is fueled by fine Thasian wine. But in one respect, at least, the philosophical symposia took place more in literary imagination than in real life. Freemasonry all over that, eh? Wine could be used in everyday life to reveal truth. It could expose the true nature of those drinking. While he objected to the hedonistic reality of actual symposia, Plato saw no reason why the practice could not, in theory, be put to use as a test of personality. Speaking through one of the characters of his books, Plato argues that drinking with somebody at a symposium is, in fact, the simplest, fastest, and most reliable test of one's character. Do you agree? He portrays Socrates postulating a fear potion that induces fear in those who drink it. This imaginary drink can then be used to instill fearlessness and courage as drinkers gradually increase the dose and learn to conquer their fear. No such potion exists, of course, but Plato, speaking as Socrates, draws an analogy with wine, which he suggests is ideally suited to instill self-control. So, what do you think? Is that how we learn self-control? Learn to drink? Little bits. Okay. I've wondered about that myself. Check this out. I'll be right back.
What a wonderful world. I see skies so blue and clouds so white, the bright blessed day, dark sacred night, and I think to myself, and I think to myself,
Louis Armstrong, man, life is good, isn't it? Just think, oh, we can sit here today and retrieve, a poor boy like me can retrieve music that formerly would have been only played live for kings and emperors, the clergy, the cardinals. I'm taking a little pause here. We talked about the philosophical idealism of that was happening in Freemasonry in Holland. The notion of women in lodges, no big thing. It's all been done. Part of our history. If you won't care to take a look, of course, we get a lot of heads buried into sand, and the discussion around the gender for Freemasonry often turns vulgar. Often turns vulgar. It's one of the sad aspects of for a lot of people. You know, you want to be thoughtful. And you just want to. I guess if I'm sitting around having a drink with you and we're having a good time, I'd look at it a bit different. Eh? Yeah, I think I probably would. But here's Did you know? Of course, you knew this. 1954. It was an interesting time. I was 5 years old. John Henry Cowles retired as the Sovereign Grand Commander of the ancient and accepted Scottish Rite, and he died that year. Retired from that, and he died on June 18th. It was also that same year that Fred L. Pick and G. Norman Knight, two English guys, published the Pocket History of Freemasonry. This is when, and also that same year, Freemasonry was reestablished in Finland, of all places. Hatoyama of Japan became a Mason. Hatoyama, I'm not familiar with you. But of course, the persecution went on. Masons were imprisoned in France. And lodges were formed in Germany. American lodges, if you don't mind. Anyway, I can't take you back to Finland, but I can take you to Pick and Knight's The Pocket History of Freemasonry, which I have right here in front of me, printed by the Philosophical Society. So I'm going to give you just a little taste of this before we go on. This is just a little, you know, a little eye-opener for us, I think. I'm going to talk to you about something 1914. I want you to work this into your conversation. I know you're fascinating, but around the, you want to demonstrate that the young whippersnappers may not know all the details about Freemasonry. So when you're asked about the International Compact of 1814, International Compact of 1814, I'm going to explain this so you're ready. Explain what in the world is he up to now. With the establishment of the United Grand Lodge of England, it became necessary for the sister Grand Lodges of Ireland and Scotland to be assured that the working sanctioned by their new authority was in conformity with their own. So, yeah, what's going on? What's that group? Accordingly, at the end of 1814, there took place at Freemasons Hall a historic meeting between the Duke of Sussex, the Duke of Leicester, and the Grand Master of Ireland, and Lord Kinnaird, the Scottish Grand Master, together with all other brethren from the three Grand Lodges. Woo! And at this, the eight resolutions that formed the International Compact were unanimously agreed to. By these, the definition of pure ancient masonry was declared in the same wording as in the Second Article of Union. And that, for those of you who can't quite quote the Second Article of Union, this had to do with the first, was with the new numbering of lodges. And this was solved by the respective number one lodges of the two constitutions drawing lots for first place. Simple. The ancients, Grand Master's Lodge 1, so that the Lodge of Antiquity, as already recorded, has been henceforth became number 2. So the second element was the Lodge of Reconciliation, and this lodge, appointed all by the Articles of Union, comprised amongst its 18 members some of the ablest ritualists of the day.
and the present craft working is vastly indebted to the labors of these brethren. The Reverend Dr. S. Hemming, a modern Mason, was the worshipful master. In 1814, there was a certain amount of dissension about the obligations of the three degrees. This was fomented, brought up by Brother J. H. Goldsworthy, a past master of the Lodge of Fidelity No. 3, who at its start was a member of the Lodge of Reconciliation and was later to become a member of the Board of General Purpose and a noted preceptor, and by members of the Phoenix Lodge No. 2, 8, 9, and other ancient lodges. But the trouble, which at one time threatened to develop into a schism, was patched up with the result that in Grand Lodge in 1816, quote, the ceremonies and practices recommended by the Lodge of Reconciliation were exhibited and explained. And alterations on two points of the third degree, one of which was the master's light was never to be extinguished while the lodge was open, having been resolved, the several ceremonies were approved and confirmed. And so, its labors being ended, the lodge was thanked for its unremitting zeal and exertion and ceased to be. Another important result of the Act of Union was the setting up of the Board of General Purposes, which soon became a most important instrument of Grand Lodge. So, the compact resolved that, and although the last of the resolutions ordered the circularization of the compact to all lodges under the rule of the three Grand Lodges, the only known official record of it is in full contained in the minutes of the Irish Grand Lodge. So that was the International Compact of 1814. That's in the Pocket History of Freemasonry. You can still find these little books. Mine was published by the Philosophical Library of 40th Street in New York, and this one is published in 1953. So this is you can still find these. If you search, get on the internet. I think I found this one in a box of material that was given to me. Or no, it was even earlier than that. Maybe it was one of the searches in the bookstores. It's been it's amazing, but it's time to wind down. Really, it's been a quick a bit of time. I'm shortening the format just to make this a little more accessible for all the listeners, and I hope that you've liked what we had to offer. Think about the essence. I want to just a little takeaway for you today. You have all that you need to find the answers. You have the mysteries. And here's what I want you to do. You know when you've read that line, if you see a man, remember where that comes from? If you see a man who lives within his, all the rest of that, you are that man. And I don't mean this glibly, and I don't mean this in any sarcastic way. Be that man. The one that we are reading about in that passage is you. I look forward to getting together and having you join me again next week. It's been a pleasure. Happy Mother's Day to all the mothers out there. And may the great architect of the universe be kind to you.
If I could say time in a bottle, the first thing that I'd like to do is to save every day till eternity passes away, just to spend them with you. If I could make days last forever, if words could make wishes come true, save every day like a treasure, and then again I would spend them with you. But there never seems to be enough time to do the thing I want to do once you find them. I looked around enough to know you're the one I want to go through time with. Thank you.
and dreamed that it never come true. The box would be empty except for the memory of how they were answered by you.
Thank you.